Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with all those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, the producers, the directors, the writers, the actors, the cinematographers, the VFX gurus, costume designers, production designers, composers, film editors, sound mixers, authors, you name it. Oh, and composers, of course. You name it, we talk to them. And we're going to be doing a lot of talking today. Very, very excited about today's show because you're first going to hear an interview with a director, writer-director, whom I adore. He is a friend. We have known each other since his very, very first film over 18 years ago. And I have been on his bandwagon all these 18 years. And now his wife is also now a filmmaker. And she has been on the show already with her first documentary, The Beloved Cat Daddies. But the man I'm talking about is none other than Dave Boyle, who has a smash hit series, 8-episode series on Netflix right now. It is one of my fave series of the year so far. I'm loving House of Ninjas as well as Masters of the Air, which is on Apple TV. But you're going to get to hear my very extensive, exclusive interview with Dave in just a minute. And then at the midpoint of the show, slightly thereafter, I am thrilled beyond belief to have another dear friend who is going to be joining me live, Kelly Grant, actor, producer, talking about her feature film debut, I think it is, and definitely her first producing credit. Kelly Grant is going to be joining us. She's going to call in and talk about her new film, The Easter Treat for Everyone, Easter, Bloody Easter. How can you not want to see a film that has an evil jackalope and killer rabbits? I'm telling you, this is the holiday film of the season. And I'm so excited that Kelly's going to be joining me. I have been there talking with her about this film since before it was a film, since its conception. And I'm so excited for her and her partners in crime, who will be joining me next week. So we're going to have a double dipper of Easter, Bloody Easter. You can never have too many killer rabbits. I'm sorry. Just ask Monty Python. But before Kelly joins me, we're going to talk about House of Ninjas and Dave Boyle. House of Ninjas, obviously, ninjas go back through centuries in Japanese history. But are there still ninjas? Are they this generation's covert operatives in modern society? House of Ninjas is set in Japan, present day, and it is the story of the Tawara family, the last ninja clan who abandoned their roots after a mission had gone wrong. But now, there is an unprecedented crisis that calls them back into action. This series is riveting. I watched all 8 episodes, not binge them. I did not even take a bathroom break. I kid you not. I was that involved in this series. We meet a lot. It was shot in Japan, in Japanese. You can watch the Japanese version, dialogue version, or there is the dub version. It's just wonderful. Wonderful Japanese and Asian actors. Kento Keiku, Tai Kimura, Eiji Makita, Kengo Kara, Tenta Banko is this young actor who plays the youngest family member, Riku, and he steals every scene he's in. But he also steals those scenes with Nobuko Miyamoto, who plays his grandmother, Grandmother Taki. The action is fantastic. Every production level is so well done. The cinematography is spectacular. The music, even. There is no stone unturned in this series. I am desperate for a second series. And before I let you hear my conversation with Dave, I have to give special mention to the fact that, yes, because he is the husband of the woman who made the documentary Cat Daddies, we got a cat that stars in House of Ninjas as well. Gigi the cat. And you're going to hear a wonderful anecdote about Gigi the cat and working with a cat. Kids and cats. I don't know what Dave was thinking, but you can judge for yourself. Take a listen to my exclusive interview with writer, director, producer Dave Boyle talking House of Ninjas.
David.
Hi, Debbie.
Hello, stranger. How are you?
Good. It's been too long. How have you been?
I have been fine. How have you been? How are the cats?
Everybody's great. Yeah, we're all good. I just got back to the States a couple days ago, and so just kind of getting reacquainted with everybody. But everybody's good.
But I got to tell you, Dave, you have outdone yourself with House of Ninjas. Outdone yourself.
Thank you so much.
Now, you know, one of the greatest joys of the past 18 years that we've known each other has been watching your growth as a director. And when you had that one slight falter and then came back guns blazing with Man from Reno, and you were right back on track, even better than before. It has been a joy to watch you grow and develop. But what you do here with Ninjas, you knock it out of the damn park. Just amazing.
Oh, thank you. That's so nice of you to say that. So, coming from somebody who knows one of the few people who know all of my work, all the way going back, that really means a lot.
Well, yeah. Thanks. It amazes people when it's like, no, yes, I know Dave quite well. We go all the way back to Big Dreams, Little Tokyo. Well, what was that?
Yes.
I said, people, yep. This, I binge watched the whole series.
Oh, cool. Great. That's great to hear. I always love it when people tell me that, because we wanted it to be something that you just want to see what happens next. So, that's great to hear.
I binged the entire thing. I did not even take a bathroom break. That's how riveted I was.
Wow. That's amazing.
That's how riveted I was. And before I dive into Ninjas, I just have to tell you, since you were tied up and you couldn't come on the show for Tokyo Cowboy, I love that film.
Oh, cool. Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, that and Ninjas were kind of happening at the same time. There was, I'm trying to think, it would have been the beginning of, would have been like the end of 2020 or so, but, you know, I was writing a bunch of different things and just on various jobs, and you just never know which ones are the ones that are going to go or that are actually going to happen, and so at the same time, I was writing, I was writing a couple of different things, and then the Tokyo Cowboy job came my way, and I wrote that with Ayako, and then House of Ninjas came my way, and it just sort of, you write them, and then you don't know what's going to happen next, and with Tokyo Cowboy, they went off and made it in Montana, and I was like, wow, cool, it's going, sweet, and then, House of Ninjas, I was originally just hired to write like the show Bible and the pilot, and then little by little my scope of responsibility kind of increased, and then they had me come and direct and run the show in Tokyo, and And, you know, it was one of those things where you just never know where these writing assignments that you get, where they're going to lead. And those two things happening at the same time were just an example of that, of just the unpredictable career of you know, a writer / director.
I don't know if you heard it, but, you know, Mark was on the show live, and we spent, I think, half of the time talking about you. As it should be. As it should be. But no, that film, Tokyo Cowboy, came out so well. He did an excellent job directing it. I wish I could have seen your directorial version, but everything about that film that captures the heart and that is so much fun and so delightful is on the, it's in the script. So your fingerprints are all over it, mister.
Oh, thanks. I can't wait. I'm going to see the final version at a film festival next month, so I'm really excited to check out the final finished Tokyo Cowboy.
No, I really like it. But now, getting back to House of Ninjas here, where did this, I know you worked with Kento and a couple other people on this one to develop and the writing. This is such a huge undertaking. It's so expansive, but it's also well plotted out. So what was your process, considering this isn't just a film, it starts, it ends, you're done. This keeps going and going. So you've really got to have an outlook as to where you want to take this. So what was your process like to develop this script, first of all?
Well, I think, you know, whenever, because this, although at the end of the day, it ended up as something that's very, very personal in a lot of ways, and something that I feel like, is the most me thing I've ever made. This all started as an assignment. So when it came my way, it really came down to, I've got 3 weeks to come up with something. I need to write fast, you know? And so I think that just jumping back a little ways, Kento and Murao-san and Imai-san, the three sort of guys who kind of first came up with the idea of it, they took like a project proposal to Netflix, which was basically spelled out the idea of a ninja family in modern times. And Netflix wanted to make it, but they sort of wanted a, you know, they wanted somebody to come up with a kind of a fresh, spin on it, a little bit different take. And that's when I got the call, because one of my producers from Man from Reno, Taro Goto, had joined Netflix after that film. And so he kind of recommended me for the job. And I think that, you know, especially when you have a very, very short time to work on something, I always try to find, you know, a personal way into the story. And, you know, I always loved ninjas, but I wanted to find something that was kind of, you know, an aspect to it that hadn't been explored as much in the movies that I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
And some of my favorite ninja, you know, stories back in the day, like the Shinobi no Mono series, are quite different from the more, you know, action and gadget-oriented ninja movies that you see recently. So it sort of felt like there was some sort of new take to be mined from it. And when I was researching it, I just found all these just peculiar, all these rules that ninjas had, like all the dietary restrictions and all the restrictions on you know, who you can fall in love with and serving a master, and how there were always sort of, you know, tools in the hands of a more powerful clan. And I just really felt like, you know, a modern day ninja family who are, you know, living by a set of just really old values, that was sort of an interesting conflict to mine for it. And from there, it was just kind of, you know, the other thing that I just felt really strongly about was that instead of kind of trying to have everybody sort of working in tandem all the time, I wanted each character to have their own strong, you know, storyline, so that they were the main character in their own story. I love shows where, you know, where every episode may not, you know, you may not be able to move the chess pieces all the way down the board, but every character is sort of, you know, really, really, really wrapped up and engaged in their own story, and so they're each kind of moving in the darkness, not realizing that they're all sort of interconnected in one big storyline. And so that's kind of where it started from, and from there it just came down to making decisions about, you know, what kind of challenges to give the characters, and you know, what to you know, what sort of obstacles to give them. And so that original Bible that I wrote, you know, we went through a development process at Netflix, and it, you know, got some new ideas in there, and I worked with, you know, a team of writers in Tokyo who wrote, you know, the remaining episodes based on my outlines, but they were really excited by the premise and kind of the world that I had come up with, and so they decided to do it, and you know, and then from there, there was a lot of, you know, it wasn't immediately clear how involved I was going to be, because it really was, the original job was, the mission was to deliver this Bible, but then it became sort of well, maybe you could, you know, write an episode, well, maybe you could direct an episode, well, maybe you could direct, and then eventually I made it over there and got to be there from beginning to end.
Well, I'm glad you did, but I have to say, I love the characters that we have. I love how you have mixed, you've done a beautiful job of mixing the culture and history with modern day elements, such as now all of a sudden Yoko is essentially a stay-at-home mom. She's bored.
Yeah.
She wants to get her shinobi skills, keep them sharp, keep going, do something vital. You've got a dad, and I don't know how many times he says it, but every time he says it, I just laugh. When Sushi keeps saying, we're a normal family. And I love how he always stresses normal.
Yeah.
And you've got the missing older brother who's dead. You've got now the second brother who is now the eldest, who he believes in peace and kindness and wants to pursue his own life but still honor his family. You've got a daughter who's college age, still mourning the loss of her older brother, but still trying to find her own footing as to where she fits in. And of course, then your scene stealer of the whole kit and caboodle is the brilliant Tentavanka as Riku. You could do a whole series just on him.
Yeah, he is so great. Just a really, really wonderful kid. You know, we auditioned a lot of kids for that role, and just as soon as he came in, everybody was like, "That's him." You know, just so he's a pretty, you know, I see him in commercials and stuff in Japan a lot, and just a really, I mean, for his age, he has an incredibly developed talent, and you know, he loves acting. Like, he just loves the whole process of creating the character and creating a role and everything. Just total pro. Really wonderful kid. It's funny, the very last scene that we shot with him is the opening scene of episode 2, where he's at Oda Wara Castle. So it was a big day with a lot of extras and everything. That was his very last scene, and he just burst into tears at the end of it. Aww. When everybody clapped for him, because it was such, I mean, if you think about it, we shot for more than 6 months, so for him, that's like a big chunk of his life.
Yeah.
But yeah, great kid. Can't wait to see what he does next.
But you know, then you pair him with Nobuko Miyamoto, who is Grandmother Taki, and those two are just magic together. They are magic.
Yeah, she was, I mean, that getting her in the cast was sort of a pinch me moment, and just because, you know, I love the movies that she was in, like Tampopo and Attack Me Woman. And so she was just always kind of a personal hero of mine. And so, you know, and she's very, very hard to get, very selective about her role. She doesn't, you know, there was a period of about 10 years where she wasn't in a single movie at all, fairly recently. But I wrote her a letter just telling her how, you know, I learned to speak Japanese by watching her movies, and I wanted her to be in this part so bad, and she finally agreed to meet with me, and then we got her, and she is just an amazing, just total legend. I mean, everybody on the crew was sort of in awe of, you know, being able to work with her. She's just a wonderful actor.
Yeah, watching her with Tenta is just, that is pure magic. Pure magic on screen. And of course, you have so many funny moments here. I mean, the whole series is very fun, visually, character-wise, story-wise, but you have some out-and-out funny moments here, and so many of those come thanks to Tokio Omoto, who plays Oki.
Yeah.
He is a scream.
He's kind of one of a kind, you know, and he's he comes from sort of a big acting family in Japan. His brother and his dad are also famous actors, and Tokio is just kind of, he's kind of a one of a kind talent. He's got such a, you know, you don't really have to direct him because he's got his thing, and he does it so well. But it's funny, he's so in demand as a character actor. I was asking him, like, so how many things are you shooting at once right now? And he was doing three things at once while we were shooting, and then, you know, he said that his record was six or seven things.
Wow.
So he just goes, I see him on set, and he'd be studying another script because he had to be on, you know, another set the next day. Just an incredible pro. You know, the Japanese film industry, the actors tend to be sort of double and triple booked all the time, going from set to set. And then guys like, you know, folks like Tokio, who are just so unique and just, you know, so funny and energetic and incredibly charming, they just are just crazy in demand. So scheduling is tough.
Of course, you bring in, no surprise to me, we have the cat. The cat is fabulous. It just rounds everything out. I could not imagine you not having a cat in this film.
Yeah, it seemed like, you know, it seemed like a black cat was exactly what a ninja family would have. And you know, that cat was its own scheduling sort of headache as well. There's no labor laws for humans in Japan, but for cats, you know, they have like limited work hours and stuff. So.
Oh my God. And as the husband of the mother of Cat Daddy's documentary, you have to be cognizant of cat labor laws.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I have a reputation to maintain.
That's right.
You know, but no, but that cat was lovely. You know, you just sort of set it somewhere and it just kind of stays there. There was one part where we just needed it to sort of look up, and we could not get it to look at what we were trying to get it to look at. And we told the quote unquote trainer, and he was like, don't worry, I know exactly what to do. Just roll the cameras. And then, as soon as we rolled the camera, he started blowing two whistles at once and opening and closing an umbrella, like, right off camera. And we were all just, like, jolted out of our... and then the cat just kind of, like, just sort of glanced. And that was all we got. But it's in the show. So whenever the cat's on screen, just imagine a guy rapidly opening and closing an umbrella and blowing on a kazoo, and that's what the cat's reacting to nine times out of 10.
Now that you've told me that, you know that I'm going to have to go back and watch binge again just to see the cat.
Yeah, well, I think you'll probably start to see some of the themes in there. You know, just lots of tricks to get that to kind of get that cat into the show. But we had sort of a limited time to get what we wanted out of that cat. But it was a very, very sweet cat.
And he's gorgeous. And I love the idea of the black cat because he does meld with the whole shinobi ninja concept of disappearing and slinking and hiding. And this is where I'm curious about your directorial process with this one, and particularly working with your DP, Shoji Ohara, and coming up with your visual grammar and your visual tonal bandwidth, Dave, because I love how, for the most part, whenever the ninjas are in ninja form, it's typically at night, it's dark, but you have this beautiful blue-black inkiness. And when you meld the costumes with that, they disappear. There's the one scene in the one apartment. And all of a sudden, mother and kid are there, and it's like, oh my God, is that daddy? No, daddy's not home. And our ninja has disappeared into the dark. And this is consistent, and but it plays almost like negative space with depth. So I'm curious about how you and Shoji came up with this visual grammar for that great effect throughout the series.
Thanks. No, I'm glad that that was sort of a multi-departmental effort in a lot of ways. So Kumiko Ogawa, who did the costume, we talked a lot about how, you know, we wanted to kind of keep the traditional, like, you look at them and you know that you're looking at a ninja. We didn't want to try to turn ninjas into, you know, Batman or some kind of superhero kind of thing. We wanted to keep it very utilitarian in a lot of ways. But we also wanted it to be able to have just a touch of something so that they stand out in the shadows just enough for, you know, viewers to be able to see that they're there. Or for them to recede completely if we wanted them to, mm-hmm. you know. And so that was a process of testing, honestly. We, you know, made prototypes of the costumes, we shot tests, and then refined from there. And then, you know, the production design, it was led by Yuji Hayashida and Yasuo Takahashi. You know, they also were kind of focused on, I mean, we always pictured the ninja house being sort of dark and you know, old and mysterious and having a lot of kind of deep kind of wood colors and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then having the lighting sort of give everything just enough clarity so that it keeps the atmosphere without it feeling too bright, for lack of a better word. But Ivana-san, my DP and Sugimoto-san, who did the lighting, the two of them are these veterans from Kyoto who've been, you know, shooting movies in Kyoto forever. So there's basically no situation that they haven't dealt with. They both have, both are Japanese Academy Award winners and been around the block for a long time. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful people. Ivana-san is this kind of gentlemanly, courtly, very soft-spoken, he very much wants the director to decide on what the shots are going to be, and then he wants to execute. He basically wants to be directed. He wants to know what are the shots going to be, and then he wants to sort of add his own special sauce on top of that. Whereas, you know, in the past, you know, many DPs that I've worked with, it's more of a conversation together to do the shot list and kind of decide how it's going to be laid out and everything. And he is, you know, just a wonderful in terms of his sensitivity and picking the lenses and sort of getting the, you know, I guess the contrast, not just in terms of contrast in the image itself, but in terms of large or small, the sizes of the shots, And, you know, he's just really just a wonderful presence on set as well. A lot of the conversations that we had were just about trying to get this sense of normal everyday life in, mm-hmm. into this show. That we didn't want to do something that was that felt like trying too hard. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But we wanted to present, you know, sort of a vision of, hey, this is everyday life. And then with more and more playful touches, kind of let people sink into the world and eventually get into more and more of the kind of less than ordinary, the ninja world that's hidden from everywhere else. And so I ended up picking a lot of locations that I think, you know, at first people were a little puzzled by it. Like, why are we shooting at this ordinary, you know, this is just so ordinary. Why would you want to shoot there? And it was, well, that's the whole idea. This is the ordinary world, and we're trying to show that this is just bubbling under the surface of everyday life. But Ivan got that right away, and I think he also got the tone right away of this kind of playful but still mysterious and kind of eerie world that we were trying to create.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked a lot about how to suggest that, how to keep that playfulness but also never lose the suspenseful edge. I think that it was a great collaboration, and it was also just a wonderful filmmaking experience and education for me. This is my first time doing everything in my second language as well. Nobody on the crew, just everything was done in Japanese, and since that was the case, then that really forced me to be simple and. Keep my direction as clear as possible, just because, you know, even though I speak Japanese, I'm not a native speaker, so I was also learning, you know, a new style of filmmaking, a new style of communication on this.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the whole crew and Ivana-san especially were just really lovely and patient with me.
Well, you know, something that I love that you did visually is when we get to, with no spoilers here, when there is a return of a character who appears, you've got a huge tonal shift and you're changing up your camera angles within the family house. And we now have more, there's more light. We see the window in the kitchen. Really beautiful outside. The sun is shining. Everybody's playing. Everybody's happy. It's not something we've seen before. It's kind of almost like leading into the third act, if we were just looked at this as a film. And then by the time we get to just a few episodes later with the episode 8, the eclipse, then you take us into this world. And I have to say, this is gorgeous. Gorgeous. The mist, the black and white, the shades of gray, the fog. That is a stunner. And that's another big turning point as to where, metaphorically, where are we now? Things have happened. There's a shift in the zeitgeist, in the tides. And it's so beautifully structured and shot as you lead us up to the joyous, happy, bright light within the family again. And then you bring us back to the shades of gray and what is blanketing and covering the truth. So exquisitely designed and shot, Dave. It really blew my mind.
Thanks. Oh, I got to give a shout out to, because I directed episodes 1 through 3, and then I came back for episodes 8. And then the middle episodes, I handed off the baton to Yoshiaki Murao and Tomoyuki Takimoto, who did, and Takimoto-san is the one who did the episode of the episodes where we're kind of in the house for a little bit when
mm-hmm.
They get an unexpected visitor. And, you know, that was definitely part of the strategy, was to give those episodes, you know, a little bit of a different feel. Those where we're kind of thinking into some more psychological suspense. I sort of thought of it as Debbie, what's the Hitchcock movie where Joseph Cotten comes to visit his niece? It's one of my favorite movies. The title is totally escapes.
Oh my God! Yeah, Teresa Wright, Joseph.
And we are going to temporarily stop Dave Boyle's interview. And if you're listening, maybe you know the film that Dave was trying to think of, the Hitchcock reference that influenced something in House of Ninjas. After we're done with Kelly today, then you're going to get to hear the rest of Dave's interview. But, all right, let me move things around here. Okay, juggle, 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 juggle. All right, and there she is. The inimitable Kelly Grant is with us live. Hi, Kel.
Hi. Hi, Deb.
I'm so excited. Finally.
I am too.
Finally.
Yeah. I know. This has been years in the making.
I know. And as I said at the top of the show, I've been there with you from the inception.
Yep. From the very, like, ground up, you witnessed this whole thing.
And your frustration and the angst and, oh, my God, are we going to get financing? And, oh, my God, are we going to find locations? And, oh, my God, shooting's starting. And do I really have to wear my hair like this? And I didn't know what that looked like until I saw the film.
my infamous bun.
Oh, my God. I am just... But you have worked so hard to get to this point in your career. And... You know, you've done all kinds of shorts. You've done theater. You've, you know, had little tiny walk-ons and little pieces in a couple films. But this, you are part of the major triumvirate that makes this film work. It's you, director Diane Foster, writer Alison Lobel, and the three of you star. You play Carol. Diane Foster plays Jeannie. And Alison Lobel plays Mary Lou. And Jeannie and Carol are best friends. Mary Lou is just all worried about her Easterpalooza. It's Easterpalooza, and it's got to be a palooza to beat all paloozas. But,
yeah.
So it's really the three of you are running the show here in more ways than one, because you're also all producers. In addition to the, you know, Diane is directing. And she's playing Jeannie. Allison has written the script. She's playing Mary Lou. You're all producing. How do you even, as an actor, how do you even start wrapping your head around wearing the multiple hats, considering this is your first big feature acting role? And you got to wear some other hats, too.
Yeah, it was a really great learning experience. Because I'm a first-time producer, so watching a project from the ground up, like before even thinking of the acting part, was really interesting. And then seeing all the moving parts happening before we're even shooting. Like, we were having production meetings every week, bringing on people from different departments. And this is all before worrying about acting. And then all of a sudden, I had to flip a switch. I was like, okay, now we got to figure Carol out. Now I get to do what I'm very trained to do and love doing. So then we got to play. So it was really fun watching all the hard work and prep and then getting to film. Like, we filmed for 17 days, and it was kind of a relief. I'm like, oh, I get to play now. So this is fun. But it was a really great learning experience seeing, you know, even an independent film just from the ground up, like how it's a miracle anything gets made, because so much work goes into it.
Well, talking about work, do you remember what you thought the minute you read Allison's script and you saw this character of Carol on the page?
Yes, it was just me, Diane, and Allison. We were at Allison's house, And it was during COVID. And she called us. She's like, I have a script. And we were like, we can't wait. And we sat and read. And we were laughing through the whole thing. We're like, this is amazing. And we have to make this. And the script has definitely changed a lot from that first read. Of course, going through rewrites and everything. But yeah, I remember just the excitement of like something is beginning here. And with these two girls, like we've been through a lot together and we've done theater together. But to jump into a film together was just very exciting.
Now, were you always set to play Carol?
Yes, which I thank you, Allison Lobel. She wrote that part for me. Which I'm forever grateful. And we just, the three of us love working together. So she's like, I wrote this during COVID. We're all going to be cast as this. And then, you know, we'll cast everyone else later. So I was just very grateful that she thought of me in that way.
Well, I love the role of Carol for you in this insane tale of the legend of a killer jackalope. And his little army of killer rabbits. And, of course, all Mary Lou is worried about is nothing can screw up her Easterpalooza. But then people start disappearing, namely Jeannie's husband, Lance. And it's, where is he? And then, of course, you've got Sam, who is... Zach Tanner as Sam is just great in this film. And he's the one that tells the tale of the 150-year-old legend of the jackalope. And it just goes from there. And we've got this core premise. Of course, Carol wants to help Jeannie find her missing husband. Mary Lou just wants her Easterpalooza. And you've got Sam fueling the fires. Lance is missing. And then you have this great town of people. You have all the church ladies, and you know the church ladies all make me think of my aunt down in Omaha, Georgia,
and her
and her church ladies. Of course, your costume does too, but we're not going to go there.
Right.
But the townspeople, the interaction here, while you and Diane and Allison really are, you're the three leads, but you all feed. Allison has written this script so well that everybody feeds off of everyone else. You can't eliminate any one of these characters and get the same result. You can't eliminate Lance. You can't eliminate Eugene. You can't eliminate Mayor Lou. You can't eliminate the pastor. You can't eliminate Sam. You know, you can't eliminate the professional bunny slayer, Megan. You can't eliminate the sheriff. You take, and then any of these other ladies that are dealing with the fish fry and the Easter Bunny costume contest, you are all so interactive and so interdependent. That's something I find really interesting, because this really is, it's a genuinely large cast with hefty speaking roles for everybody.
I was very proud of how it felt like such an ensemble, and they did such a good job of like letting everyone have their moment. Like each church lady gets their moment.
yes, they do.
Even my children get their moment, you know? So they did a really good job of like letting everyone shine and making this town feel real. Like these characters live in this.
Well, and that's the interesting thing, too, because this is set in a fictional town of Wahlberg in Texas, truly rural upon rural upon rural. But you were shooting all over Southern California.
Yes. That was challenging. We're like, okay, we can't afford to fly everyone to Texas, so how are we going to make this feel like Texas? And they were scouting, and we found some really good spots. Like we shot on this ranch that Ronnie let us shoot on, and that felt like Texas. And then they found that church and like, because we also wanted it to feel a little like creepy.
Yes.
And one location, when we're in the woods, we are literally up in a mountain. It was a little scary to drive up that mountain because there was no railing.
Oh, God.
But I know. I was like, oh, no. But there, it was great. Like, we were literally in the forest. And it just worked out really well.
Now, because you are a producer, were you involved in the location scouting, or did you leave that to Diane?
We were all involved in that. So that would be a part of our production meetings of, you know, if we needed a bar, we considered Backstage and Mom's, where I bartend. So that was part of that. But we ended up using a different one there. And yeah, that's what we would. Everyone was kind of assigned a job, and it was like all hands on deck. Who can bring this in? And, you know, then we would all agree on it and lock it down. So, yeah, it was very much like a group thing when we were in our production meetings.
And you didn't 86 the mountain drive and no railing on the side of the road?
No, because the location was too good. It was like perfect. Yeah, because we were able to shoot like in three different places just in that one location.
All right.
So it was really great.
All right.
It really felt like we were in the forest.
Well, it looks like you were in the forest.
Yeah.
Because you've got some really great scenes, and I'll talk to Diane about this next week when she and Allison are on, but there's some really good camera work happening, and she really takes advantage of what Mother Nature has put there.
Yes, and as an actor, that was really helpful, because it was, and all of our effects were mostly practical, which also, like, you're grateful as an actor to, like, be able to react off of these things and react to nature. And, you know, some days I really was scared. I'm like, is a snake going to come out here? But it was really helpful on the day that we were shooting.
Well, obviously, I've said it enough already. We got killer rabbits here. We got a killer jackalope that's huge. And we have all these little killer rabbits with demon red eyes. Now, did you get to act off of the practical effect of red demon-eyed bunnies? Obviously stuffed ones. Or did you have to pretend at that point?
Oh, we got to act with the bunnies. Miles Cooper, who's he plays Eugene, but he was also a puppeteer and was like had the bunnies on his hands. And I was so worried one day when I'm hitting them with my weapon, you know, I didn't want to hurt him, but, you know, that was something I had to factor in because it was nice to physically have them, and especially the jackalope, because Jamie, who played the jackalope, he's like 6'4", himself, but then he puts the costume on and it gives him like more inches, and that part, those scenes with him were great. I was like actually afraid. I was like, oh, you are a giant creature. Like, this is, I'm not doing a lot of acting here. You look very scary in person.
Okay. Now, you telling me how tall he was, because I was wondering if Diane had him up on like an apple box, you know, kind of like a Jimmy Stewart kind of situation, because he was so tall. And, mm-hmm. you know, some female co-stars, they would have to be, because of eye line with the camera. But no, so he definitely is, Jamie is definitely that imposing as the jackalope.
Yes, yeah, and he really brought it to life, like, even with, like, his subtle breathing, like, he was using his whole body to breathe and make the jackalope move, so it was just, those days with him on set were so fun.
Oh, my God. Now, there's also a lot of blood here. And when you're doing things practically on a low budget, no budget, micro budget film, such as Easter Bloody Easter, how many takes do you get or did you get in some of the bloodshed moments?
Not many. And Diane's famous line on set was like, we need more blood. So we definitely had fun with it. But there's one scene, especially with her, where we had one shot, and that was it.
And I know, and you and I talked about this shot already, but we're not going to give it away.
No, I don't want to give that away.
No,
there is blood.
No, because it's a good one. It's a good one. Now, with so many people in this ensemble and with everybody interacting with everybody else, did you get rehearsal time? Because a 17-day shoot is not that long.
No, and we did get rehearsal time. I think that's why we were so successful because, you know, we are a low-budget independent film, so time is money. I think our first rehearsal was the Bunny Hop dance, and we got the whole cast. And Diane choreographed this dance, and one, it was the funnest thing ever because this was back in 2021. You know, we're all coming out of COVID, and it was just so fun to be in the room with the whole cast and get to work on this dance. And at that moment, I got to be a part of it because we thought we might be in the Bunny Hop dance, but that changed later. So I still got to learn it. But that was a really good rehearsal day on set. And then we also had a stunt coordinator who was amazing, and we spent hot days at his place working through all the stunts just so day of we were ready and, you know, we were not wasting time. So the prep is so important, especially on low budget films. So you can just get there and make sure everything runs as smoothly as possible.
So you were doing your own stunts. Thankfully, you did have a stunt coordinator who could teach you.
Yes.
Was there any stunt that was really challenging for you to bring to life as Carol?
The big one for me is a battle with a demon bunny. And we had to, like, I really had to figure out and imagine, like, one, where the bunny is getting me. And, like, you know, I had to throw myself back on a mat. So that the trust there that, you know, I wouldn't get hurt. So I really had to, we had to do that a couple times. And just, like, making it, you know, selling it. So that it was fun, though. Like, the stunts were very fun.
And, of course, now I'm sure you're wishing that you could have a mat like that anytime you decide to do something silly, like ride on people's shoulders in case you fall.
Oh, yes. We know my history with that, Deb.
Yes, yes. That is very
No piggyback ride.
No. That is very inside baseball, people.
There was an injury.
If you know Kelly, you know the story.
The big injury.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you got mats and you were properly trained because you do have a lot of physicality in this role. All of you do.
Yes. Yeah. And those days were very fun. A lot of rolling. I remember one day Diane, she had to do this roll. And, you know, we were in the forest, so she accidentally cut her knee. But she was ready to keep going. So we made sure to bandage her up and, you know, kind of lay. It was interesting. We had to lay a mat down in the forest and then cover it up with leaves so you couldn't see it.
Wow. Wow. You guys really did look at every little detail in bringing this thing to life.
Yeah, it was a labor of love, really. Like, we were all so, it was honestly, maybe I'm biased, but the best set I've ever been on. Like, everybody, there was, like, no drama. Everyone was just so grateful to be there, and you could feel it.
You know, what is, for you as an actor, because you've been plugging away at this for a long time, as long as I've known you, and you and I are looking at more than a decade.
Yep.
That's why this show today is really special, because first I have Dave's, you know, my interview with Dave, and we've known each other 18 years since his very, very first film. And then to have you on the show, so I love it when I get to have my friends.
Yay.
And I've been there with you on this journey as you're studying in your acting classes and trying. And now it's all come together here. So it begs the question, Kel, what is it about acting that has kept driving you all these years?
That's a good question. It's the passion of it. Like the feeling you get when you know you affected someone. Like I've done drama, I've done comedy, I've done both. And that's always what, that's when I fell in love with acting to begin with, was the way like a movie or a play made me feel. And then when I get to do that, when I get to hear people laughing or like the room is so silent because I know like emotions are happening, you know, it's just very powerful and it just feels right. Like, you know, I do many other things, but acting is just, it's what lights me up. And when I, you know, this is just so exciting and feels so rewarding to come to this point now. And, you know, we're having our premiere this Thursday, the 21st, and I just want to enjoy it. I'm like, man, we got here. Like, this is a big moment. And I just want to really have fun and just feel grateful for all that.
Because this is your first premiere.
Yes. And I don't know what to wear.
Well, now, wait a minute. You know, while as Carol, you have to look very dowdy in Goodwill thrift store in what you're wearing. I'm being nice. You know that. I have other choice words. I have other choice words I could say. But, you know, there is a scene where you get to dress up and you wear that great red dress.
Oh, it's beautiful.
So why don't you wear that to the premiere?
I was thinking about that because they let me keep it because they said it fit me so well. And the woman who did our costumes was so sweet. And yeah, they call that, everyone on set was calling it my sateen dress from Moulin Rouge.
Very much
like,
so.
I would like that. Yeah.
I think
that's
you should.
That's my pretty moment.
I think you should wear that to the premiere.
I might. Yeah, that's actually one of my options. I have three options. So, well, I think it's going to be day of call.
I think that would really be the best thing. And then people see you on the red carpet and then they see the film. So I think that'll be a nice surprise for them.
Mm-hmm, I agree. That would be just a fun moment.
You know, that would be my choice for you, is the red dress.
I love it.
That's, you know, that would be my choice. Now, I'm curious for you, because you have done theater. How beneficial do you find doing theater, doing stage work, when it comes to then doing screen work, be it television or film? Do you find that stage experience helps you, especially in a film like Easter Bloody Easter?
I do, especially like theater. One, for any actor, is a great starting point. Like even when you go into a class, a lot of it is scene study, and you just really got to get comfortable being in front of people and being able to be vulnerable. So I think that is a very good starting point, but also take film classes too, because you've got to get comfortable with a camera. And now that the industry has pretty much moved to self-taping, there's different movements. Like you still got to have the same emotion, which theater is going to teach you. But then you have to hold it, you know, somehow it's got to leak through your eyes and you can't be big with it on camera. So you got to find a way to still have the same level of emotion, but in a smaller capacity and less movement. So I think both kinds of training are really beneficial. And as an actor, you have to, you know, think about it. Would you prefer to only do stage, or is film really where you want to be? Or is it both? I prefer both because I get different rewards from both. And like on theater, you get to live in the whole moment. You get to act out the whole story every night. Whereas film, it's all broken up. So you really got to have that skill of like, okay, on this day, where are we in the script? What am I bringing? What are my before moments? So I think both kinds of training are really good.
Because you did not shoot this in order.
We did not.
You did not. You know, because blood had to be used sparingly but judiciously. You can't. This is the kind of film you can't shoot in order.
No.
No. So you have to be able to jump back and forth and transition your emotions. Now, you brought up a really good point about more and more auditions are going by the wayside and everybody is self-taping. Was there a learning? Because I remember when you were going on auditions.
In person, back in the old days.
In person. You know, the old days, yeah, 5 years ago. You were going to in-person auditions. Was there a learning curve for you going from in-person auditions to self-tape?
Yes, there was a big learning curve and like an attitude shift, because I've seen some actors who were resisting it and getting upset, understandably, because you really can't replace being in a room with a person. Like, I know that casting director saw me. You know, with self-tape now, I have to be my lighting person, my editor. You know, I've learned a lot. But luckily with YouTube, it's all out there, like, for you to learn. And my attitude shift, I was like, okay, instead of fighting this, I'm going to get good at this. And that's going to matter. So I was lucky enough to have a spare room and able to, like, paint the wall and get good lights. It does cost a lot of money, unfortunately, but, you know, I was just like, this isn't going to go back to the way it was, so why don't we get good at this? And, it's been fun, and I realize I like editing. Like, that's been kind of a fun learning curve.
Oh, you know, don't tell me that. Don't tell
me. I
could, like, put you into service for me editing stuff.
I would love to. I'm still a newbie. I'm doing the basics, but I think it's fun. I like it.
I have to ask you, because Marie Noel, that's, you know, her big thing is editing. Did you ask Marie for any tips and techniques?
I didn't. But yeah, I know she's big in editing. Yeah. Luckily, my husband, Chris, he's really gone down the editing rabbit hole, so he really helped me, because before he was doing all my editing for self-tapes, and then I was like, wait, I should probably be more independent and not, you know, if he's not here, I need to be able to do this. So he really helped me. We like sat down and had little lessons.
and
there's so many good apps now. Like, I would recommend InShot. I've been using lately is a really good editing app for your auditions.
I'm glad Chris, you know, was good for something in this process.
I know. I guess that's why I married him.
Yeah.
You know?
And, you know, don't get me wrong, people. I know Chris. I adore Chris. And Chris knows when I say something like that, it is done in the spirit of fun.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Now, I got to ask you two questions. What is the greatest lesson that you learned? Or what did you learn about yourself as an actor in making Easter Bloody Easter? And then on the flip side, what did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker, as a producer in making Easter Bloody Easter?
So as an actor, I would say what I really learned was trust. Like, trust the process, trust the vision. And then it'll come together. Like, trust who's in charge, trust what they're seeing, what they're telling you. And because, you know, as an actor, we can't, like, see our work right away. Mm-hmm. We can't see how it's all going to come together. Just really enjoying the moment and trusting. And then as a producer, I learned, like, 100 things. But I think the biggest thing was just, like, it's never like we can't do this. It's how are we going to do this? Like, mm-hmm. That's the mind shift. It's like maybe we can't do it this way, but how are we going to move forward? Because I watched Diane do that over and over again of like just pushing this thing forward, and no was never an answer. It was just, how are we going to get here?
Well, now this,
that was great.
This begs the big question. Because you have been in different productions with different directors, different kinds of crews, different kinds of actors. This production of Easter Bloody Easter, what is it, 90-95% female cast and crew. So I don't want to hear anybody saying there are no females out there making films. Because this is a prime example. Do you think, how beneficial do you think it was for this production to have your department heads, Alexa, your DP, Nancy, your editor, Haley, your production designer, costumer, Caroline, you know, Diane, the three main stars, all female, and right on down the line with your visual and special effects people are also female. How beneficial was that for this production? Do you think it made a difference having a female-centric cast and crew?
I do. I think, one, that's Wally Bird Productions' mission. That was Diane's mission. She wanted 100%, but that was, you know, tough. But that was always her goal. And sometimes she had to go looking a little harder to find the right people for the right job. But the attitude on set was amazing. Like, I felt like it was so fun to look around and see mostly women. Like, that was, I never see that on a set. So that was, like, very fun for me. I was like, oh, this is great, like, and exciting. And yes, like you said, there are women in these positions. Like, Alexa Cha, our cinematographer, she is loaded up carrying that heavy camera. And it was just amazing to watch her work. And, yeah, I would say it was very beneficial. And, like, hire more women. They're out there.
Yes.
They want to work.
We know they're out there, you know.
Yeah.
But, again, the key thing, and you said it, finding the right person for the job. And in some cases, it's not a woman. It might be a guy like your composer. Mark Vogel did the scoring.
Oh, and he is amazing.
He is
such a gem of a human.
But it is all about finding the right person for the job. And you might have to look, like you said, Diane looked till she found the right person for each of these positions on the crew. And I think that's something very, very important. You don't just go out and hire some, you know, women just to have women. And you don't go
They got to be qualified.
You don't go out and hire guys just to have guys. They've got to be qualified.
Mm-hmm.
And the proof is in the pudding when you see the film.
Yes, it is. So everyone, go see Easter Bloody Easter.
And it comes out on the 26th, correct?
Yes, and you can pre-order now on Apple TV and iTunes, which is very beneficial for independent films because that helps us get more eyes on it and seen. But March 26th, you'll be able to buy it on YouTube Movies, Amazon Prime, Google Play. And then after that, down the road, it'll go to streaming.
Now, I watched it on a 55-inch screen in the living room. So I love it. At some point, I would like to see it on a big screen, but I'm not coming to the premiere. But now, is there a theatrical on this one, too, or is it all streaming?
No. At this moment, I think it's just digital and streaming.
Which is pretty standard, because Gravitas is releasing this.
Yes.
So, and Gravitas knows I love them. You know I love Gravitas. I talk about Gravitas all the time as being like a fairy godmother to all these low-budget, no-budget, micro-budget films. And I'm glad they picked up this one.
Yep, they were on your list of people who should look at it. You were so excited when I told you they picked it up.
I have my list. You know I have my list.
You know it.
For everything, I have a list. Well, my friend, I know you have to go to the airport today.
I do. My family's coming because they're walking down that red carpet with me. I'm very happy about it.
So I'm going to let you go. Of course, the show ran late because you know me. It always runs late.
And yeah, we're chatting.
That's right. And we're going to be chatting again more on Wednesday, aren't we?
Yep, I will be there.
Okay.
Bartending.
I will see you Wednesday then after I see Ghostbusters Frozen Empire tomorrow night.
Oh, yes. Let me know how that is.
You know I will.
And thank you for having me, Deb.
Thank you.
It's been a long time coming.
Thank you for coming on the show. And we didn't say...
Yeah, this has been great.
We didn't say... You know, Steve was only on, what, 4 times?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. 4 times. Our good buddy Stephen Alaric has been on the show. He's been in studio for an entire for an entire hour at the time.
Wow.
With Steve. And of course, Frank Meyer has been here now twice. Frank's coming back on April 22nd
when
when he gets back from his his next tour. I think he's touring with Fear this time.
He is, yeah. I think he's going back to Spain.
He's going back to Spain, and I keep seeing every day they're adding new dates.
Which is so exciting.
I know. And I just love watching all of you just blossom and grow over the years.
I know. It's been a journey.
It has. And hopefully there will be many more after people see you as Carol in Easter Bloody Easter.
Yes, I hope so. We're definitely already working on a sequel, so it's coming.
I want my sequel. Yes,
we're on an early draft right now.
I'll take Mother's Day. I'll take Labor Day. I'll take Halloween. I'll take Christmas. I'll take Thanksgiving. You could do a funny one with turkeys.
So many options.
Lots of options here. So... All right, my friend, I will see you Wednesday, and
we
will chat before your premiere.
What was that?
Before your premiere, because the premiere is the 21st.
Yes, you will see me excited and nervous.
Yes. All right, you, and of course, Chris can listen to this later tonight when I get this up on the website.
Perfect. I'll let him know, and my dad and sister, too.
It'll be up on the website and out on Podbean, on all the little podcast platforms.
Yay, so, sounds great. I can't wait.
All right. Love you. Thank you so much. And,
yeah, thank you so much.
And I'll see you Wednesday.
Okay. Bye, Deb.
Bye, Cal. And that was Kelly Grant, actress, one of the 3 lead actors and producer on Easter Bloody Easter. Next week, director Diane Foster and writer Allison Lobel, who play Jeannie and Mary Lou, are going to be joining us. So we're really getting in the Killer Rabbit Easter spirit here. Pam's looking at me like, oh my God. but now, as promised, we're going to go back and finish up my pre-recorded interview with Dave Boyle. And I'm wondering, how many of you... No, the movie that Dave was thinking of, the Hitchcock movie where Joseph Cotten comes to visit his niece, played by Teresa Wright. And all of my TCM friends out there are going to laugh when they hear this, and I may not be able to show my face again. But here we go.
And I'm blanking on the title. I know it. I have it in my head. He is the twisted uncle.
I think that, you know, we start off on sort of a playful note, you know, and Takemoto-san is known in Japan for his, you know, kind of hard-hitting psychological thrillers, and he felt like a great choice to kind of take the reins for, you know, when the story was kind of hitting... when the characters are kind of hitting rock bottom towards the end. And then I took the baton back for episode 8 when everything kind of comes together. And I just felt like, you know, we just had to really just go for it in episode 8 and just not hold back and just go, you know, we've taken people on a real roller coaster ride, and I wanted to make sure we finished off with a bang. And, you know, that sort of, that battle in the fog, it started out as, I mean, first of all, you know, we needed to kind of, I wanted a texture that we hadn't seen in the movie yet. Something that sort of, you know, so much of the show takes place in these ordinary locations where the school a factory or just kind of really everyday spots. And I wanted one place where we could sort of have an excuse to go into a little bit more of a fantastical realm. And since we have these enemy ninjas who have this pseudo, you know, religious aspect to them, then it made sense to me to have, you know, a ceremonial room that was kind of filled with this poisonous smoke. And then, you know, that gave us an excuse to have some fun visually and give people sort of a little bit of a more of a taste, and we're getting deeper into sort of this hidden ninja world in places that we haven't seen before, and into a more metaphorical space. And you know, as that was the lighting department and the effects department spent a couple of days working on that fog, because all that fog is practical. You know, mm-hmm. when people are appearing and disappearing in it, some of it's slightly augmented in post, but you know, it all sort of hangs beautifully in the air, like it's painted in, because it is. You know, there's all these guys with these little handheld smokers that were sort of putting these big swirly designs in that and we'd have to redo it before every take. But they spent a couple days in the studio at Toho Studios, basically just lining all the catwalks overhead with space heaters, because they just had to get the balance of the cold air, they just basically had to get the temperature and the pressure in the mm-hmm. room just right to get the fog to hang long enough, you know, for us to get the shots off. And so that was a really, really intense, but really fun scene to shoot. And then in post, you know, I mean, by and large, we did not, you know, we were not doing crazy visual adjustments to what we shot, but that scene, you know, the colorist basically did a full black and white version of the scene and then layered it over the original color version to give it basically just that exact, you know, because it's funny, you tweak the original footage and then you lose the definition on the fog really quickly, but when we sort of, you know, overlaid the images instead, then all of a sudden, you know, the characters take on more clarity, and the fog also maintains, you can see, you know, you can sort of see the intricacy of the design of it, and you can see the fog moving with the actors as they move through it and everything, and I thought that was really cool. I can claim no credit for it. I was sort of watching and nodding along, but it was, that was a lot of fun, and I was really proud of that scene.
And by the way, our Hitchcock movie neither one of us could think of is Shadow of a Doubt.
Shadow of a Doubt, of course. I mean,
all right, Dave. I am in love with the bookend structuring of your needle drops. Your song selections are incredible. Yeah. And then Jonathan's score, you know, that fills in the gaps and throwing in some jazz is great. What were you looking for musically to really bump this up?
It's a very emotional show, but it's also, you know, content-wise, it's sort of, it has a lot of DNA of kind of the B-movie in it mm-hmm. as well. So I wanted to, you know, with the music, I wanted to signal people that we were having fun, first of all. That was one thing. But also kind of ride the line of this very, very suspenseful story that also is very poignant and, you know, in a lot of ways sad. And that was what the needle drops were about, kind of keeping that sad but fun kind of note in it. And then in terms of the score, I mean, when we were, you know, because we played everything pretty straight, but I felt like the score needed to kind of be pretty big and really a character in the show, and I drew a lot of inspiration from like great giallo scores of the 70s and 70s and 80s, and that was what a lot of the temp music was. And Jonathan Snipes is a wonderful composer. I was a big fan of his, you know, documentaries that he did with Rodney Asher, but he was also sort of a member of this band called Nilbog that covers like great giallo scores from mm-hmm. the 70s, so I knew that he would understand that whole world and basically the overtly the very, very emotional. I wanted a score that was just very, very emotion driven and also, you know, sort of keeps that B-movie spirit alive, even though it's a very, hopefully, A-movie execution in a lot of ways. And he's wonderful, just brilliant. My collaboration with him was just a great experience.
Well, I love the score, the needle drops, bookending it structurally with each episode, perfect. Everything about this, Dave, the entire series, I want a second season.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're doing well, and we just have to wait for them to decide if we're doing well enough to, you know, learn more. So I hope so. I'm ready if people want it.
I want it. So there. Yeah, I want
it. Debbie.
Dave, thank you. I know Mia's going to shoot me. But thank you. It's so good to talk to you again. Say hi to Mai for
Likewise.
Me.
Will do. Thanks,
All right.
Debbie.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Dave Boyle, writer, director, producer, House of Ninjas, now streaming on Netflix. If you haven't seen it, do yourself a favor. See it. It is so good. Great action. Great humor. Characters that you just love. And a couple that you may not love so much, but boy, they're fun to watch. And mark it on your calendars. Go now to Apple TV. Pre-order Easter, Bloody Easter. It drops on the 26th, just in time for the Easter Bunny to put a little coupon in your Easter basket for viewing. So, of course, we're way over. That is all the time we have. Next week, Diane and Allison will be here to talk about Easter, Bloody Easter again. And until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.